Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I've got a bit of a cold, but I still have a question. Is there a really bad war brewing over the Ukraine? Let's get to the bottom line. Ukraine finds itself caught in the middle of a tug of war between Russia on one side and the West, NATO, Europe, and the United States on the other. Russia has beefed up its military presence all along its border with Ukraine, and President Vladimir Putin insists that Kyiv must remain firmly in the Russian axis. The two countries have been waging low-intensity war for the past 8 years, and Ukrainians are split on which way to go. Putin has said that even the prospect of expansion of NATO into Ukraine is a major security threat, and he just won't allow that to happen, blaming the United States for the current instability. Europe and the United States says there'll be huge repercussions for Moscow if it does invade Ukraine. So where do things go from here? Can the tensions blow up into a full-scale war? Today, we're talking with American diplomat Kurt Volker, the former U.S. ambassador to NATO and the former U.S. special representative for Ukraine. Ambassador Volker, it's terrific to be with you. And I have to tell our audience that you're in Ukraine right now. What are you doing in Ukraine at this moment?
Right. Well, thank you, Steve, for having me. It's great to be here. I'm in Ukraine because today we are formally opening the American University Kyiv. This is a project I've been working on for a couple of years. It's a partnership with Arizona State University, and we are going to be offering American-style education and American university degrees fully accredited for students in Ukraine here in Kyiv. We're starting with graduate students in March, and we are welcoming undergraduate students in September. And since this is the bottom line, let me tell you, the bottom line of this is that we have confidence in Ukraine. We believe in the country. We believe in the young people. We believe in its independence, and we believe in its future as a European country. And so we're making this investment today.
Well, let me ask you, and I don't mean to be too facetious with this, but I mean, one might question, you know, the timing that you're doing with this university. It sounds great. But isn't this part of the package of things that Vladimir Putin is saying he doesn't want to have happen? May not be the university, but NATO expansion, further integration into the West, his concern that right on Russia's border, you have an America and Western tilting nation. How do you sort that out?
Yeah. Well, first off, I want to rephrase the way that you discussed this in your opening. I don't see this as a tug of war between Russia and the West over Ukraine. I see this as either supporting an independent Ukraine, which Ukraine obviously does and the United States and Europe does, or trying to have a subordinate Ukraine, one that's subordinate to Moscow, which is what President Putin wants. So by supporting an independent Ukraine, I don't think that's a tug of war. I think that's empowering the Ukrainians. And that's something that Vladimir Putin is afraid of, because empowered Ukrainians who control their own government and who build a prosperous democracy that's part of Europe will then be an example to Russians who wonder why they can't be a prosperous democracy and a part of Europe. So I think that's the issue. It's Russia's efforts to hold Ukraine back versus Western efforts to empower it. As to the timing, you're absolutely right that there is a chance that Putin will invade Ukraine again. He did so in 2014, took Ukrainian territory, and is poised with over 100,000 forces to attack again. If he does that, he can certainly make major gains into Ukrainian territory. But this is the whole point, though, is that in the end, Ukraine is the country that will succeed. They'll succeed because they have a distinct, strong national identity. Their people believe in democracy and the ability to choose their government, and they see themselves overwhelmingly as historically and today part of Europe. They don't want to be part of Russia. And so I think in the long run, Ukraine will prevail, and it's up to those of us in the West to make these investments, to build these connections, and to help them succeed.
You know, I respect Ambassador Volker, Kurt, we're friends, the way you framed this as a set of choices for Ukraine. But there are a lot of geostrategic observers who see this as really the first major geostrategic test of President Biden and America at this moment under his stewardship, under his leadership, and that what Biden does one way or another will have a lot more repercussions beyond Ukraine. What do you think Biden is getting right? What do you think he's getting wrong?
Right. Well, I think, first off, I agree that this is a major strategic test, but Ukraine is the device. What Putin is really trying to do is rewrite the security architecture of Europe. If you remember, after World War II, it was Yalta, and it divided up Europe between a Western sphere of influence and a Russian sphere of influence. From 1975 Helsinki Accords onward, it was different. It was respect for every nation's sovereignty and territorial integrity, non-interference in internal affairs, non-threats of use of force in Europe, no changing borders by force, all these things that have prevailed for 50 years, but now Putin is trying to rewrite them. So I think, first off, what Biden is getting right is rejecting Russia's efforts to rewrite those rules. The answers to Russia's demands to the United States and NATO that were delivered in Moscow last week were very clear. No, we're not going to rewrite European security rules that way. We will talk about arms control. We will talk about transparency and confidence building measures, and we'll do it on a reciprocal basis with you. That we are very happy to do, but we're not going to assign to Russia some sphere of influence that puts you in charge of other countries. So that much is right. The part that I think could be stronger from the U.S., there's a couple. One of them is Ukraine needs security assistance now. If there's any way to prevent a Russian attack, it is for the Russians to believe that the costs of that attack would be too high. I understand that we will not come to Ukraine's defense. They're not a member of NATO, and it would put us in a direct conflict with Russia. But we should be doing much more and more rapidly to get arms to Ukrainians, trainers to Ukrainians, advisors, maybe some U.S. forces not on the front lines, but to help the Ukrainians behind the lines. If this were John McCain, we would have a full-scale train and equip program up and running already for Ukraine. That, I think, is something we should be doing. Another thing that we are doing is sending some forces to Eastern NATO countries so that they feel reassured. That's good. And then a final thing that I think that we could be doing is getting the messaging right. After Afghanistan, where there was a catastrophic withdrawal, the Biden administration seems determined not to repeat any of that scenario at all. So if Russia does attack, we will have already told our citizens to leave. The problem is that we are sending these signals now, telling Americans to leave Ukraine and not go there at a time when everything here is normal and peaceful. And the president of Ukraine is trying to keep calm and exercise confidence. And I think the U.S. should also be trying to project confidence together with Ukraine that in the long run, we know that Ukraine will prevail. In the long run, we are Ukraine's friends and we're not going to cut and run. And I think that messaging is getting mangled at the moment.
You know, Kurt, you did a extraordinary interview with Ryan Leza of Politico recently, a podcast that I would highly commend our listeners to listen to. It was called A Former NATO Ambassador Gets Inside Putin's Head. But in that, you reminded me of something I had forgotten about, which is that the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Soviet Union comes at the end of this year, 2022. How is that a driver, do you think, for how Putin sees his role in history and in Russian history and what he's trying to do?
Yes, well, thanks for bringing that up, Steve. And of course, Ryan is the second best interviewer in Washington. the story there is that the Soviet Union was founded on the remnants of the Russian Empire after the Tsarist collapse, after World War I. It lasted for 100 years when the Soviet Union being founded in 1922 until today. And so 2022 will be the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Soviet Union. Putin was a KGB officer in Eastern Germany, and I think he felt betrayed by Gorbachev and by the leaders of the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union collapsed, and that the Soviet Union may be gone, but he, as Russia's leader, is going to rebuild Russian greatness and to restore a greater Russia on the territory of the former Soviet Union. So he has till December 30th of this year to mark that 100th anniversary. And if you look at what he's been doing over the last, I'd say, 15 years or so, he has rebuilt the Russian military. He's upgraded, renovated the nuclear forces. He has taken over parts of Georgia. He's taken over Crimea and parts of Ukraine. He has never gotten his forces out of Moldova. He now effectively controls the security forces in Belarus. and recently was able to take control of security forces in Kazakhstan as well. So this is quite an ambitious set of undertakings. And I think Putin sees himself in the tradition of Peter the Great or Catherine the Great as people who built Russia, built a greater Russia, where it was a powerful country, respected in the world. And I think he sees himself as in that mode, and this is the year for him to do it.
I understand why, you know, on why we might not deploy U.S. forces or NATO forces there, but we certainly have in other countries. You know, part of out-of-area missions is one of the big tasks that has kept NATO alive and things right. beyond its borders. Why wouldn't this classify as an adequate out-of-area mission, given it would be another attempt after 2014 to redraw the lines and boundaries of a sovereign nation?
Right. So many complicated things in your question there, Steve. The first one, let's start with out-of-area missions. That phrase came up when we had the wars in Bosnia, brutal ethnic cleansing, and NATO was saying, look, we're not obliged to defend anybody because they're not NATO members. But then we were so appalled at the ethnic cleansing that NATO decided that it would intervene to stop the killing and then put in place a peacekeeping force under a UN mandate. So that's how this out-of-area concept got started. Around 2002, there was a Reykjavik ministerial meeting of NATO. Colin Powell was our Secretary of State then, and I happened to be there with him. And we ditched this concept of out-of-area because it's not about who you're defending. It's about where the threats are coming from. And we don't control where the threats come from. They could come from terrorists, as we were thinking after 9/11. They could come from Russia or the former Soviet Union, when it was the Soviet Union. But nowadays, we're even talking about cyber attacks that come from anywhere, or even possible threats from China. So this out-of-area concept is less poignant right now. But what we do face is NATO members saying that, look, we're not obliged to defend Ukraine, and if we try to do so, we will be in a direct conflict with Russia, and that could escalate into a wider war, not only over Ukraine, but over Europe generally. We don't want to be in a war with Russia. Let's find ways to try to manage this without directly defending Ukraine. So that's the way the issue has morphed over time here. To your question about appeasement, and is this a modern-day version of appeasement. Let's start with what Hitler was doing, what Stalin was doing, and then think about what it means today. You had Hitler claiming that there were Germans living in other countries, and those Germans should actually be in Germany. They should be part of Germany. Germany needed Lebensraum, a place where all Germans could live in adequate space for all Germans. He then also said that he had security concerns over some of the neighbors. And then he signed a secret deal with Stalin to divide up Poland. And this was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. So from 1939 to 1941, and I'll come back to why I say 1941, you had Hitler not only consolidate power in Germany, take over Austria, take over the Sudetenland, and then all of Czechoslovakia, and then gang up with Stalin to launch an invasion into Poland and divvy up Central and Eastern Europe between the Soviets and the Nazis, and then turn his attention to Western Europe. The U.S. did not get involved in World War II until the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor in 1941, December 7th, 1941. So there was a long time when Chamberlain went to Munich and said, okay, we'll give Hitler the Sudetenland and that'll be enough. And then they take that and they say, well, we'll stop at Czechoslovakia, that'll be enough. And the reality is Hitler's appetite grew with the eating. And the fear is that Putin, having already built up a greater, stronger Russia than before, taken territories already from Georgia, from Ukraine, including Crimea and part of the Donbass, keeping territory under his control from Moldova, now expanding his reach and putting forces just this week into Belarus. There is a feeling that, okay, he is demanding more and more. And then we saw this on December 17th of last year, 2021, he presented his demands to the U.S. and to NATO. These were demands, no NATO enlargement, rolling back deployments of forces to the territory of Central and Eastern European members of NATO, recognition, if you will, of a Russian sphere of influence, no nuclear missile presence in Europe. So everything you could think of that would have been the wish list of the Soviet Union back in the day was on Putin's wish list in December. And this, again, is upending the European security order of over 50 years. And the concern that people have is, should we be even entering into a negotiation over this with Russia, or should we really be telling them a firm no and putting in place capacities to make it clear that the cost to Russia of just trying to impose that kind of order would be too high? And that's where I think making sure we do the latter, put in place the capacities to show Putin that he can't just do it on his own, would be necessary to avoid any kind of a modern-day appeasement.
I think that history is really important to understand because, you know, I think it sits in the minds of many Americans and Europeans watching this, looking at, is history going to repeat itself, or how do you avoid it? But there's another dimension here which also plays eerily back to the past, which is in your party. I can tell our folks you are a known Republican, but there's a split in the Republican Party that's, you know, very overt, where even some senators almost sound as if they're rooting for the Russian side of this. But at minimum, on the lesser side, some are saying this is not our conflict. We should not be picking a fight with Russia over Ukraine. Ukraine doesn't matter. And so I'm interested in what the dynamics, because that sounds to me like a kind of isolationism, which was also part of the 1930s equation.
That's exactly right, Steve. That's exactly right. And I think you put your finger on it. There are voices in the Republican Party that adopt that view. There are also more traditional pro-national security, you know, proactive voices in the party that are speaking out. And so this, you hear both from both sides. I would also say you hear it on the Democratic side as well. Some are more proactive in pushing national security, and others are saying, you know, this is, we have no dog in that fight. It's over there, and we want to focus on other progressive domestic issues here at home instead. So you get it on both sides. And I do think it runs the risk of being a new type of isolationism where the absence of the U.S. in the world or the absence of U.S. leadership creates a vacuum that the worst actors exploit first.
We recently talked to journalist Kati Martin about her book about Chancellor Angela Merkel and about previous times where Merkel played such a vital role in managing Putin because Barack Obama didn't want to. What does her absence today mean? Is Europe playing the role it should? Does Angela Merkel's departure from her role matter in the current equation? Is Putin seeing that as an opportunity? What's your view on the kind of the Western European dimension of this?
Yeah, this is an immensely complicated question as well. And Kati understands this so well. She, as a little girl, was in Budapest and spent time living at the U.S. Embassy before her family was able to get out of the country because of the Russian revanchism of after the 1956 revolution. So she understands exactly that kind of failure to respond when the Soviets were on the move. Concerning Western Europe, Chancellor Merkel played a double role. We kind of have to appreciate it, but also think about, you know, was it enough? She kept Europe on track, united with sanctions against Russia because of their earlier invasion of Ukraine and occupation of Crimea and Donbass. So she refused to allow the EU sanctions to be relaxed, even though there were countries in the EU pushing for that. At the same time, she was tremendously committed to not confronting Russia in any way, particularly any kind of military pushback or security pushback on Russia, and always seeking to engage Putin, which has the perverse effect. It was not her intent, but it meant that all the pressure was put on Ukraine. Russia gets a pass, even though they're the ones doing the attacking and occupying. And everyone says, Ukraine, can't you do more? Can't you reach out to the people in the east? Can't you implement the Minsk agreements, even though you don't control the territory anymore? A lot of pressure on Ukraine, a lot of moral equivalence, even though one was an aggressor and one was a victim. With her moving on, we've seen a further dynamic. The SPD, the Social Democratic Party of Germany, now has lead position with the chancellorship. You'll remember that it was Chancellor Schroeder who was the last SPD Chancellor of Germany before Merkel. And when he left, where did he go? He was hired by Vladimir Putin to chair the Nord Stream consortium and is in charge of this Nord Stream 2 project that is so controversial in Europe today.
Right.
So the SPD is now leading the chancellery in Germany and has a desire not to put this on the table or to confront Russia. That is making Germany's position look weak, probably making it look even weaker than it really is. They have been taking some steps, including promising that all sanctions are potentially on the table. Then you have France. Macron is going into an election this spring. He wants to increase his profile as a negotiator. He's been talking to Putin directly. They've reconvened the Normandy format negotiations with Ukraine and Russia and Germany. He is looking to position himself individually or uniquely to help his reelection prospects. Boris Johnson was just here in Ukraine the other day. He is pushing up the UK's image as an independent actor now after Brexit. And then you have Italy, which, like Germany, has a lot of vested economic interests with Russia and would rather see if there's not some kind of accommodation that can be made. So Europe is really, under the surface, reasonably divided over what to do about Russia and Ukraine, and in a much weaker position than it was when Merkel was chancellor. That,
right.
By the way, that explains a little bit some of Putin's timing. It's not just the history of the Soviet Union, this being the 100th anniversary year. It's also that we face a transition in Germany, maybe a weaker Germany. We face a divided Europe. We face the appearance of weakness in the U.S. after Afghanistan.
Right.
And the fact that in the long run, Ukraine will end up being a stronger country over time. So Putin may think that now is the best time.
Right. Let me just get one last question. You have about a minute left, Kurt. And that is, you've said in an interview that you thought there's a possibility that Vladimir Putin might invade a limited territory in the north, the south, and the east. And so my question is, if that were to happen, will we find ourselves then accommodating to Ukraine's?
I think it is more likely that he would only try to take the south and the east, although he might invade from the north as well, just to create multiple fronts. But I think that is more likely than a full-scale invasion trying to take the whole country or even Kyiv. And I think I wouldn't call it two Ukraines. What I'd say is we have an unoccupied, a free Ukraine, which I would hope that the West would embrace fully if that were to happen. And then we'd have an occupied part of Ukraine that will probably remain occupied as long as Putin is president of Russia, which may be a long time, but I don't think that it lasts that way forever.
Well, thank you so much, Kurt Volker, former U.S. ambassador to NATO and former special representative to Ukraine, now co-founder of the American University in Kyiv. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Steve.
In the struggle over Ukraine, here's the test for President Joe Biden. Is he going to be a realist and cut a deal, recognizing that Ukraine is just the wrong cause to spill American prestige and blood over? Or is he going to be an idealist who believes in standing up for Ukraine's sovereignty and its freedom of choice, and that no cost is too great to bear for these universal standards of decency and international order? It's a really tough call. Both come with great costs. There's no easy way out of this conflict. Russia has the ambition and it's willing to take risks. And America's fatigued from 20 plus years of wars. And there's just little popular support in America today to defend a faraway nation. Until Biden decides what his strategic game plan is in the world, Russia and China can easily make America look weak and indecisive. And that's the bottom line.